It's February 20th, and we are talking with Mrs. Harold Geiger, Thelma Geiger, who was for 30 years an employee of the Alliance Review and retired as editor of the Society page. And Thelma, we'd like to go back 30 years to the time when you started with the Alliance Review. Do you remember what year that was?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
1942. And that was in August of that year.
Fine. Now, when you began at the Review, you didn't start as society editor.
No.
What was your position then?
Well, I went in as general assignments, but at that time, as you recall, that was right in the middle of the war, and that probably was the reason that I got my job, because the men were away in service. So I was sent to the City Hall beat. Although I didn't stay with it too long, that was my first assignment at the Alliance Review.
So the City Hall beat would have generally been given to a man, would it not?
Almost always, and has since then. And they refrained from giving me police court because they felt that was a little bit rough for me. So they still sent a man over to police court, but I covered everything else.
Mm. And of course, this was in World War II, and there were many women doing men's jobs.
That was our first chance to get our foot in the door, and we've kept it in ever since.
Now, let's talk about the City Hall beat. Now, City Hall in 1942 would have been in the building that it currently occupies,
right? That's right.
In what we call our City Hall. You would have gone there how often? When would you go to get your news?
Actually, that was a daily beat. You would go in every morning, and it would have to be fairly early in the morning, and because you still had to meet your daily deadline. Now, I covered the public offices such as safety service director, the mayor, the clerk of municipal court, I'm trying to recall, going up and down the steps.
Yes.
I think the Office of Civilian Defense was still there, I believe. And I got the routine news of the day. The arrests or anything else, of course, was picked up by whatever reporter we sent over.
To the police
yes,
court.
Yes, to the police court.
Would you, when you made your rounds at City Hall, have talked directly to the city officials, or would you have spoken to others in the office?
No, we spoke directly, or rather I should say I spoke directly with the city official because there was too much chance of error if you got your news from a secretary or if you got your news from any intermediary. So you went directly to the mayor or to the safety service director, and if he wasn't available, it meant a return trip.
You went
see
back.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have any problem getting past the secretaries?
No. Once they knew who it was, no, everything was fine.
So The City Hall was very cooperative with
very
the
cooperative,
news
yes.
agency. That would make sense. I think it would be mutual.
Well,
benefit.
If we ever got into any sensitive areas in which it might be premature to publish anything, we respected it, and they realized that we did. So that way we earned their respect and they got ours too, our cooperation.
That's commendable. I don't think that's always true.
In the larger papers, no it isn't. Because your competition is a little bit. Of course today you have competition with TV. We didn't have that then.
That's
See,
true.
We had the sole control of local news.
That's true. That you had competition now from television, but in 1942, would there have been any competition from television in Alliance?
Not television, but radio.
Radio, all right. We have radio station WFAH. Was it in existence in 1942?
Yes, I think it came in shortly thereafter, and it was initially located in the old brick building that was once the home of Mrs. F.A. Hoyles. Mr. and Mrs. F.A. Hoyles on South Union Avenue. It is now an apartment complex and doctor's offices. But that's where station WFAH originally started.
Okay. Now, the Hoyles connection is not only with radio station WFAH, but it has a connection with the Alliance Review, does it not?
Yes. Of course, the Hoyles family was initially owned by F.A. Hoyles. And at the time that I went to the Review, he was deceased. But his children were running it. And prior to the time that the Hoyles family took over, of course, other interests owned the paper because it goes back a good many years. See, I think it's about 125, 130 years old.
Yes, we have the Alliance Review on microfilm back to its early days, and I know it goes prior.
It was known by various names: the leader, the news.
In the early days, it was. Well, at that time, then you did have some competition from radio, but the radio station was not as strong then as it is today.
No, it wasn't. Although we did operate competitively, our staff worked solely on their own. Their staff worked independently of us, and very seldom did we exchange news.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think the competition also was not just that you worked as separate staffs, though owned by the same corporation, but it was also that you actually competed to see who got it first.
We did.
How often, do you remember how much of a broadcast time they had? Were they on the air for very long then?
Oh, I think they were on the usual amount of time, probably signing off around 11, maybe signing on in the morning around 6:30 or 7.
Well, they covered a full broadcast day.
Yes, they did.
So there would have been quite a bit of news that they would have had to have gathered, and I imagine you crossed paths with their news gathering team. Did you speak to one another?
It was cooperative, but it's rather amusing to recall that whenever we had any celebrations, such as dinners and that sort of thing, we had our separate dinners. We didn't indulge in fellowship too much.
I see. And that kept the competition
keen. Yes, it kept it alive.
Oh, well, let's go back to City Hall Beat. We were talking about the cooperative aspect that a reporter had with the political heads in town and how you respected their wishes to not release the story right away. And that was quite an admirable characteristic. Do you think that that has changed over the years?
Oh, yes, I do. I think it has changed quite a bit. And I'm not speaking specifically about the review, because you do have your TV competition today, which is news on the spot. And you do have, in some instances, competitive papers. Although, in Ohio, that's now reduced to just the major cities: Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, in which you have a morning and an afternoon. But by and large, most other cities have, it's a monopoly. And but it is competitive with that. And I think sometimes in the competition, you're inclined to be a little more rash and dig a little bit. Maybe I've been seeing Lou Grant too much on TV, but it's that sort of thing. And the reporters are eager to get back with the news before anybody else. And we didn't have that problem.
Mm-hmm. It was different.
Yes, and it still is different today with your small town dailies. Mm-hmm. It still is different.
Yes. Now, City Hall Beat that you had covered, do you remember the mayor that you would have had then?
I think the first mayor that I, shall we say, worked under would be Floyd Senn. And I can't tell you too much about him because I was not on the City Hall Beat for too long. And I think his term ended shortly after I started. And then Mayor Kirkland, Sam Kirkland, came in. And Sam served for 2 years and refused to run another time. And Sam was the co-owner of the K&W Motors at that time. And I don't think that he had ever been involved too much in politics, but he was very well liked, and his friends convinced him to let his name be put on the ticket, and he won very easily and liked political life, but Mrs. Kirkland didn't.
I see.
And it absorbed too much of his time. And so when they came around and asked him to run a second time, he said, no, I think it's made too many inroads on my family life, and you better let someone else come on. Well, in the meantime, I was taken off of City Hall, and I was put on general assignments. So I didn't come into too much direct contact with the municipal officials, and I don't think I can go much further than that when it comes to remembering a great deal about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting story about Sam Kirkland.
Yes.
Sam is still in Alliance today, and he is considered the presiding official at a round table down at our local candy shop called Heggie's. And that is where a number of the city officials and oh, some of the heads of businesses congregate over coffee, and Sam kind of presides at that table. He's complete.
Well, I think Sam has the common touch. I mean, he has a wonderful sense of humor, makes friends very easily, and he was still alert to the needs of the city and made a good mayor. At the same time, he was extremely well-liked.
Now, when you left City Hall Beat, now, what do you mean you went on general assignments? What would those consist?
Well, even though it was called general assignments, we had a specific beat, so to speak. The schools, anything that involved the schools, whether it was in elementary or the high school, the Red Cross, and the old community fund, which was the forerunner of the United Way as we know it today. And then just features and general assignments, but that was a regular beat in which, when I say regular, you had to make contact with any of these specific organizations every morning to make sure that nothing had happened overnight or nothing was going to happen that day so that you wouldn't be caught napping.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned contact with the City Hall beat, meaning you went there every day.
Yes.
Now, when you had a broader coverage here.
Telephone.
By telephone.
Mm-hmm.
You made your contact
yes.
by telephone.
Mm-hmm.
But every day.
Every morning, yes. So that you couldn't be caught napping and something happened that, in those days, possibly we have slipped a little bit today in not being so inflexible about having the news within 24 hours after it happened. But our editor was determined that today's news would be today's news, not yesterday's. And so your contacts had to be made every day to keep yourself up to date and to keep your news up to date.
My word. Now, when you had covered City Hall Beat and then you moved to other assignments, you would have had to have walked to City Hall, right? Did
yes.
you did you have a car and did you drive then too?
No, but then walking to City Hall was just
around the corner.
Around the corner.
But that's interesting. Then you would have been totally dependent practically upon the telephone.
To some extent, with the schools, yes, the telephones, and with Red Cross and with United, or with the old Community Fund. However, if there were specific things to attend to cover, that also involved covering board meetings and anything else that would come up. Then, of course, those were generally in the evening, and you had to do that by car. Well, I had a car that was a family car that I used. Now, if we were sent out during the day on assignments in which a car was involved, the photographer went along. And we used a company car. So we went in pairs.
Oh, I see.
Now, that is where there has been a tremendous change, because as a reporter then, you were not required to know how to use a camera. Today, almost every reporter must know how to use and must take his or her pictures on the spot.
And also use his or her car, because does the review still maintain a company car?
I don't think for the editorial department. They're given mileage, but they don't have a company car.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the business office and the photographer, they do. But we were expected to rely on our own.
This would represent, in general, the change in automotives in society,
yes.
too, because in those days you could have obtained your job at the review and not been expected to have a car at your disposal.
We were not initially expected that. It wasn't necessary.
Whereas today, those reporters are very much dependent upon
It's almost a must today that you do have some means of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in the larger papers they do have stamp cars, which you can use on schedule. But in your small town newspaper, I think they're still operating that you provide your own.
Hmm. Now, when you covered, well, let's say the schools, can you think of any of the major happenings that occurred during your time of general assignment with the schools?
Well, of course, we went through a growing period in which there were new schools being built, particularly Stanton Junior High, and additions to some of the other buildings, State Street specifically. And I remember they're tearing down the old Park and Broadway school, which was an elementary building.
And that would be where the fire station
That's
is currently
right,
located,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why they decided on building Stanton was because the community, State Street, was no longer able to take care of the entire influx of junior high students coming in. And so they decided they really needed one in the middle of the city as well as in the south end. to take care of both.
And so they selected Stanton, which is standing now at the corner of Broadway and Union Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it was built as a junior high, as was State Street,
yes.
Though now the educational concepts have changed, and it's called a middle school.
That's
covering
right.
A different
mm-hmm.
section of grades. Did they have any problems as to where to locate the school? Do you recall?
I don't recall that they had any problems, although it had to be thoroughly investigated by architects and contractors to make certain that it was a good place to build. And I think they ran into a little trouble after the building was erected, after about a year, in which they had some cracking of the corridors, that is, the floors. And that was because of the settling. Because part of that, I think, is on a fill.
See,
a good deal of South Union to the west is on a fill. But they rectified it, and I don't think they've had any trouble in recent years.
Mm-hmm. This is an area along Broadway, and as well as South Union, that we have many buildings, such as the one we're in right now, the public library,
yes.
is located on a fill,
yes.
with pilings that go down quite far. So basically, they located the school after study, but no one complained as to the location. It was
I don't think there was ever any dissension on choosing that location for a junior high.
Now, how did they get the money to build the...
Well, of course, through a bond issue, and it passed the first time, but it was a five-point bond issue in which the new Stanton Junior High was included, and then in addition to State Street, in addition to Franklin, and a new Morgan School, and then multipurpose rooms for North and South Lincoln. However, the funds ran out after they completed the first three projects, which were Stanton, of course, and State Street and Franklin. So they had to go back to the public for funds for the other three projects. Well, as so often happens, if you don't carry out your word with the general public, they lose faith, whether they're right or wrong, and it took repeated placement on the ballot before it finally passed. And I can't tell you now whether it was two or three times, but I know it was at least two.
That's not news as far as history of bond issues today is concerned, but one can understand the reluctance of the voters. But they did achieve it,
yes.
then, because we do have a Morgan School building. Why was the name Stanton selected for the junior high?
Well, B.F. Stanton was probably in our public school system longer than any other educator, and by that I don't mean as a teacher, because I'm sure we have people who have been in the system more years, but as an educator and superintendent, he was in at least 30 years. And he retired in 1942. So actually, I never got to know the man too intimately, but because he was a well-respected educator for so many years, they decided that this was an excellent chance to honor him. They named it after him.
So it was named after an educator. Would it have been the only school that had a name for a person? Do you know? That's just out of curiosity.
I'm thinking of Morgan School, but I believe that was named because of its location rather than after the Morgan family. Because there is a Morgan Avenue.
Named, yes,
yes,
and it's very near the Morgan industry as well.
And you
well.
See, if you just run through some of the other names like Franklin and Liberty and
there.
North Lincoln and South Lincoln, as far as I can recall, that is the only one that bears the name of an Alliance educator.
It's quite a tribute, then,
mm-hmm.
to Mr. Stanton. Was it in this period, then, when you were doing general assignments that you worked so closely with the Red Cross?
Yes. And, of course, that brings to mind the late Mildred Eales. And she had been associated with the Red Cross for over 30 years. And my daily contact was with her. I would call every morning, and she would tell me or refer me to someone in her staff that could give me any news of the day. Of course, the Red Cross is a many-faceted organization, and they branch out into family service, and which at that time was service to families of men overseas. And the blood program, and we became quite involved in the blood program with a daily visitation of the blood mobile unit, and that meant that at least two to three weeks ahead of time, we would have to start promoting through the newspaper because we had a quota of so many donors to reach. And so that was interesting, too.
You mentioned a daily visit of the blood.
No, not a daily visit.
Oh, I see.
No, it came once a month.
I see.
But a 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time, we'd start informing the public trying to get human interest stories that would stimulate people into signing up, because there had to be a registration, you see, for it, so they would know exactly how many are expected to show up.
Right. The blood program is still running the same
way.
Also the tremendous need to start in advance to encourage people to give blood. You mentioned the types of articles that you may have written in order to enlist sympathy. Do you recall?
Well, I think of the first retarded class in Alliance, which was started in the basement of the Union Avenue Methodist Church. And that was at the time when they were bringing the retarded out of the closet, so to speak. We had more or less ignored the problem. But through the generosity of the Methodist Church, which opened up its facilities to there were two classes. And I remember, of course, Mrs. Alveda Wagner, who has since retired, but she worked almost most of her life with the program. And it was a remarkable progress that was achieved through these classes. We did the first story as the classes were conducted the first week, and then we went back possibly 6 months later, and the progress was really amazing to see what she and her staff were able to accomplish with these youngsters.
She was very well known for her service to these children.
It takes a very dedicated, special person, and Alveda Wagner was just that.
Very definitely. Now, these began in the Union Avenue Methodist Church. Were they linked? Was she employed by the school or by the church?
I think she was employed. I think her salary came partially from the parents, who were required, when able, to pay a portion. And the rest of it came from the county and then indirectly from the state.
But eventually, then, these classes
it was turned over then to the county under the state.
Right, and taken into the school system.
Yes.
And out
right.
of the church.
That's right.
What year would it have been, roughly, when these retarded classes began?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say possibly 25 years ago. Now, that's strictly a guess.
Mm-hmm. In the 1950s.
Yes, yes.
Sometime
mm-hmm.
around then. Because now the retarded classes and services to handicapped children of all ages is very much a part of the school system.
Well, public awareness has increased so much, and as well as sympathy, and we realize that there is much to be done for them. At that time, a retarded child was simply looked upon as a lost child, and he was tolerated at home and kept out of sight. But these classes brought them out. And the one thing that I recall so vividly is the love and affection that they have to give.
Yes, very loving children. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is and can be tremendous improvement in their capabilities.
Yes.
Perhaps this was never shown before because they were never given an opportunity.
Well, I believe it was that, I don't recall the exact percentage, but a retarded child was not permitted in a public classroom unless he was 50% educable. And if the norm was below that, he would not be accepted. So many of these children were then in the homes with the parents trying very hard to accommodate the family life around the youngster. But there was much that could be done. And I recall this one child who, a young girl, who was never able to stand still. She was constantly in motion, so much so that she could never eat with her parents at the table. Within a matter of 2 months, Alveda had her sitting at the table and quietly working at different things. And you can imagine how much that meant to the family.
Not to mention the child,
mm-hmm.
too, who must have felt
yes.
very deeply the rejection mm-hmm. of not being able to eat with the parents. Why, that's amazing. I would imagine, too, that in providing the coverage in the newspaper, it would have in some way helped the acceptance of this program.
Well, that was our reason for doing the stories in the first place, was to educate the public as to what was going on. I think so much of rejection is through ignorance, and I think too many people didn't understand
true.
And then they had open houses in which they did invite the public to come in. And that was a revelation, too, to see what they could accomplish.
Since it was such a sensitive area at that time, did you take photographs of these children?
Yes. There was never any objection. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we were selective. Because there are so many grades of retardation. So we were selective in that there would be nothing that would offend the parents and nothing that would offend the reader. And it worked out very well.
Mm-hmm. In regard to taking photographs, what was the procedure for taking a photograph? Did you make special arrangements in advance to take them?
Well, generally, there were arrangements in advance. If it happened to be a personal interview, you almost had to let the person know that he or she was going to be photographed. There were many things they might want to do to prepare for it.
Women always want to get their hair done.
That is true.
True.
And many a time, we had to arrange our interview after she had been to the beauty shop. Plus the fact that it was self-protection, because there's nothing more difficult than walking into an interview with your photographer and having the interviewee say, oh, I didn't know my picture was going to be taken and I don't want it.
Yes.
So we made sure that we crossed all the bridges before we got there.
Now, did you have to have any written evidence that you had permission?
No, not unless it was in an extremely sensitive area in which you felt that there might be repercussion, but very, very seldom. We didn't have any problem there.
Usually it's just the opposite. I think many people enjoy having their picture in the paper and would cooperate. Matter of fact, perhaps there'd be more who'd want it taken that you didn't possibly have room for. We're moving closer and closer now to the time of your role as society editor. Were you on general assignment for very long?
Yes, I would say, out of the 30 years, I think about 12 to 15 of those were spent as the society editor.
I see.
Which was pretty evenly divided, the first half on general assignments, and then moved into that when Althea Yarnell retired. And she had been with the paper 25 years.
And she was the society editor.
Yes, and that is the only assignment that she ever did.
Well, before we move into the society editor, is there anything else from general assignment that you recall that?
Well, not particularly. There would be the schools and the community chest, which eventually evolved into the
United Way
as we know it.
Would this have been the period of time when you mentioned that you did the tearjerker type of story?
Well, that was almost from the very beginning, and we would get leads on that, and then we'd contact the people. And we worked that in with our regular assignments. I did features on general as well as when I went into the woman's page.
I see.
So I've really done that throughout the 30 years.
Right. Do you find that there is less use of tearjerker stories these days?
Well, I wouldn't say there's less use, but I think they are being treated more matter-of-factly. Less emotionally than they used to be. And maybe that's merely a reflection of the changes of time. It just seems to me that there's a little bit more callous approach to what might have been a tearjerker. But that, too, can be attributed to the fact that our values have changed, too.
It also might have something to do with the fact that in the earlier years, we were, for charity, you were more dependent upon the individual giver. In other words, you wanted help from individuals. Whereas today, I think many of the charity cases are more dependent upon the bureaucracy, welfare structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have had something to do with
it. That's had a lot to do with the type of story and the way it's handled today. Plus the fact that you have a whole new generation of young people coming on in the journalistic field, and I think they have come into it with an entirely different angle, too.
True. It would reflect not only their own outlook, but also the journalism schools.
Well, they're
today
far more mobile than we were, because in the original years at the Alliance Review, we stayed. Althea, 25 years. John Hanlon, 25 years. Of course, Clarence, well over 40 years, Clarence Steffi. And myself, 30 years, Cy Butler, 25 to 30 years. And now, if you stay 2 years, it's a long time. They move on.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And you know, they would be more mobile as far as their day in the office, because I would imagine that when you use the telephone in the earlier days to gather your stories, you were together more in that office, in the newspaper office. But now, with their day and their automobile, they get out of that office more, I would think.
It's not being sentimental to say that we actually did regard ourselves as a family. We were the Review family, and I speak of the editorial department. But today, I think, and right or wrong, who's to say, but I think it has changed.
Yes, with
and,
that.
It is a job today. And possibly the greatest.
We were talking when the tape ended about the Review family and about the feelings that were there during your years of service, and possibly the changes you saw as the newspaper reporters became more mobile and this now lack of a family feeling. You mentioned in naming some names, people that you were associated with and who were associated with the Review for many years. Let's take Clarence Steffi and spell out his office there, because that he was the editor, wasn't he?
Yes. Well, Clarence started as a general assignment reporter, and then came World War II, and Paul Reed, who was editor at that time, because he was in the Army Reserves, was called into service, and Clarence stepped in as editor, a position which he did hold until his retirement. When Paul Reed came back from service, he then was put in as general manager of Station WFAH. And Clarence stayed with that for the rest of the time and continued to work at the Alliance Review 2 years after his retirement, doing columns and that sort of thing. And it's, as I recall things about Clarence, he was born in Hartville. He was not a native of Alliance, but from the day that he moved here, he adopted. This is his hometown. And from that time on, I don't think we've ever had a more dedicated or devoted citizen than Clarence Steffi.
I would second that from what I knew of Clarence Steffi, too. Definitely a promoter of Alliance. Alliance never had a much better friend than it had in Clarence Steffi.
Well, I often heard him say that he felt that Alliance people were something special, that they were unlike people anywhere else in the United States. And of course, that brought forth a good many arguments from the office staff, but he genuinely believed it. And that was his philosophy throughout his years at the Review.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was reflected in general in the type of editorials that he had and in the type of paper that he ran and produced as editor.
Well, sometimes I feel that his editorial columns were never controversial. But I think that was because he felt Alliance could do no wrong. And he found it very difficult to enter into areas that were detrimental to Alliance.
That's true. But he did it more as a positive approach rather than as an effort to whitewash.
Oh, no, there was never that. No, no, he thought Alliance was too good a town to need whitewashing.
What about some of the younger reporters who may have come along during his time? Did they give him battle over things like this?
Well, the only one that I think of is the current editor, and that would be Jim Hastings, who came directly to us from Kent State University. But Jim was born and raised in Marlboro, and he had the hometown feeling. And we had a succession of reporters come and go, but not particularly for any reason. They would come in and fill just one spot. We never had any other vacancies. It was generally one area in which we'd have them come in, and maybe they'd last a year, maybe 2 years, but on they would move.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was also, I think, beginning to reflect that greater mobility in the young reporters, too. Do you remember when Clarence Steffi retired? It would have been in the 19...
Well, he was about 67 when he died. And I think he has been gone about 4 years.
Take it back to 1976 that he
had passed
away.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he would have retired about 2 years before that.
2 years before that, yes.
So in the middle 1970s mm-hmm. that he retired and was replaced then by Jim Hastings,
yes.
who was the current editor of the newspaper. What about some of the other names that you mentioned? Cy Butler?
Cy Butler, yes. Cy Butler was with the paper for a long, long time, and I think Cy can be best remembered for his work with young people, because it was Cy who originated the Hostile League, which eventually became nationalized, but never gained the same momentum as the Little League. And we often discussed this in the office and felt that possibly the reason for that was a selection of the name, because the Hot Stove League brings up an image of a pot-bellied stove, an elderly man sitting around swapping stories, mm-hmm. whereas your Little League brings up the image of youngsters in baseball uniforms. But Cy's work with these youngsters was really remarkable. And as I understand, that is the reason for the park on West Main Street being named in his honor.
Butler Rodman Park. Mm-hmm. I had wondered where the Butler mm-hmm. came from. What was his capacity at?
General assignments.
Mm-hmm. Did he also incorporate sports into that, or was there
yes,
a separate?
Yes. Whenever the sports editor was on vacation, he would take over. And the sports editor was John Hanlon, who worked for many years.
That was another name that you had mentioned, too. What
yes.
do you remember about
yes.
John Hanlon?
Oh, John was an eccentric. He was a bachelor. I can't remember too much about John, except that he was a lantern-jawed big man, but a very good sports editor, not biased in anything that he did. And that's easy to do when you're handling sports. And I don't know if you remember Bert Dunbar.
Oh, yes.
Well, Bert Dunbar was John's constant companion because Bert had a photogenic memory for scores. And while it didn't extend to much of anything else, whatever John didn't get that evening at a game, Bert could remember.
And he remembered it strictly from his memory, too.
Yes, and he could remember addresses, telephone numbers, and sports scores. He could tell you, even if you asked for a score 2 and 3 years before.
Wow.
But other than that, Bert was lacking.
Yes, those were his strong points, and he did not have that capability in other areas.
He attached himself to John, principally because he admired him, and John allowed it, principally because Bert was so helpful if he didn't manage to get down the scores or whatever inning or whatever. Whatever, because I'm not that familiar
whatever
with
piece of information
yes.
that he needed. Then would you have found Bert frequently sitting at the review?
He would come in to see John frequently, and whenever John went anywhere, he would ride with him. Now, he never came in and made himself a nuisance in the office. He never came in and took up space, but he was always with John when John went out in the evening.
Obviously, they both cared very much
yes,
about sports.
Yeah, he understood Bert, and Bert adored John. And the two made a pretty good pair.
And between the two, we probably always had the scores right.
Yes.
on any of the games. Any other names that you recall?
Are you speaking of the review?
Well, in general, those were the names you had mentioned that were directly with the review. What about Mr. Siddle?
Oh, well, there is another man, and I would say there's a great similarity between Mr. Siddle and Mr. Steffi, because in both instances, they were thoroughly sold on Alliance. they both tackle their support in different avenues, because Clarence could support whatever the community did on the editorial pages. But Mr. Siddle started out, he came from Findlay, and he started out as a review in the advertising department as advertising director. And then, following the death of F.A. Hoyles, he moved in as general manager with Mrs. F.A. Hoyles, still as president of the firm. But he was a promoter, and he promoted Alliance whenever he could. And at the time that they were holding the drive for the new city hospital, he gave page after page of support in ads to that, and worked very closely with Edgar Turkle in bringing us a new hospital. He was the first one to start the community Halloween parade. And I recall that after he went out to Copeland Oaks Retirement Community, that was one of the things that he felt so badly about, was several years ago they decided to abandon the Halloween parade. And he had felt very deeply that that was a community endeavor, and he hated to see it go along with other things.
I had not realized who he was and what he had done.
Well, he, and another thing that he did, he brought the merchants together in so many cooperative efforts in promotions. But of course, there again, we see a change in our mode of living, the super centers that come into the picture, and individual ownership of many stores has disappeared. And at that time, I would say almost every store on Main Street was individually owned, with possibly the exception of Sears or Penney's. But that picture too has changed.
That's true. At that time too, there would have been more stores on Main Street. I find it hard to believe how many clothing stores we had at one time.
Yes.
And of course, this gets into an area you know a little bit more about.
Yes, yes.
Through your husband too. But it has changed so much over the years. You just do not have that many clothing stores.
Well, and there are very few locally owned stores anymore.
This is true.
And that in its turn has taken away from, I think, the personal element that held the community together as far as Main Street was concerned. And it's pretty hard to get someone who is sitting at his desk in Chicago or St. Louis or someone else to feel the urge to support Alliance, which is
the
far away.
Community. Mm-hmm. This is very true. And of course, it's a little hard to stimulate, let's say, a community spirit among these stores. Let's get together and promote thus and so. Well, these are general managers now who must request permission, as you say, from someone sitting in Chicago, and they're not interested, perhaps, in competing with the store down the street on Main Street in Alliance.
That's where Mr. Steffi and Mr. Siddle shone. I think they both worked in their own way to support community as a hometown endeavor.
And of course, it would be reflected in the types of advertising now, as well as the type of articles that you have in the newspaper.
Well, so often your ads were prepared locally, and now too often they come from the chain, from the offices of chain firms, and are sent in through the mail.
It truly has taken away the personal touch.
It has.
It? Anyone else that you recall?
Well, of course, I recall Mr. Rodman, who did his philanthropic work, I think, in a little different way. He lent his name and he lent his money to various projects throughout the city. And he was an extremely well-respected man.
This is true. Now, this would be C.J. Rodman.
That's right. Of course, Jim Rodman is still here, and he's on the faculty, as you know, at Mount Junior College. I'm talking about his father.
Yes, and he was... Well, the Rodman name is well known in the community because of his philanthropic gifts.
And then when I say he worked in a different way, I think of Edgar Turkle, who also worked very hard for the city, and particularly in the new hospital. But Edgar had to give his mostly in time and effort. And there are very few testimonies today that you can see of what he did. But he and Mr. Siddle worked very closely together on the hospital project.
That's true. Now, Edgar Turkle was a mortician.
That's right, Cassidy and Turkle.
Funeral director, yes, for Cassidy and Turkle. Yes, those are two names that that one still recognizes. And, of course, their families are still here.
Yes.
Yes. This, too, as far as fundraising in the community has changed over the years. Again, with the same patterns developing, rather than your locally owned companies, where one man owned a company and could say, well, now Morgan's is going to give so much to the hospital construction and American Steel Foundries will give so much. These also have passed, by the way, and changed into Chicago-based corporations.
Yes.
There are very few family-owned corporations left. So that, too,
that's
changed.
Yes.
And not necessarily for the better.
Not
as
always
far
for the good,
the
but you
support,
have to move with it.
But you have to recognize that it is a different situation now, too. Hmm. Well, let's go into the time, then, when you became society editor. Now, this would have been at what period?
Well, I was around 1957, somewhere in there.
And before you became the society editor, you mentioned Mrs. Yarnell, who had held that position for some years. Did you get trained by her in advance, or were you just handed the job?
I was handed the job, but I had previously been the society editor of the Canton Repository, and that's where I got my initial training. The only time that I worked, shall we say, for Althea was when she was on vacation. And of course, her retirement was a surprise. None of us knew that she had planned it. And so the job was a surprise to me, too, because I didn't know they had decided to ask me to take it. And I didn't want it, because it took me out of the field of reporting. It was a desk job. And but I learned to adjust, and I learned to like it, and stayed with that until I retired.
That's amazing. Did you find that you had a different style in your editorial handling of the society news than she?
Well, I didn't try to make any changes for a year. But at the end of that time, Society News was still reporting in meetings, very extensive reporting in meetings, with little time or little space left for features or for family living. And so we tried to change over the format of the Society page to include features on women, features on families, and we had two publicity tees to inform our contributors as to what we had in mind, to ask their indulgence, because it's hard to break a habit, and to pass out some publicity handbooks, which we had printed. And little by little, we met some opposition. Habits are hard to break. But little by little, they came over to our way of thinking, and we cut down on the length of the stories. We cut out the unnecessary, what we felt was unnecessary in reporting meetings, thereby allowing us more time and more space to develop the stories and features about people throughout the community. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we started a series of first ladies, and we did interviews with Mrs. Hamrick. That would be Jane Hamrick, the wife of our current superintendent of schools. We did it on the late Mary Evelyn Weber, who was the wife of Dr. Weber at Montana College, and Nancy Puckett, the wife of our current mayor, and also on Alison Hall, who is the wife of Harold Hall, and who at that time was Marlington District Superintendent. He now is Assistant Superintendent of Starr County Schools. Then we went into a series on women in business and professions, because I think at just about at that time, women were emerging out of their unknown status into professions of their own. And we would do, if I recall correctly, we did a woman doctor, a woman attorney, a realtor, a banker, who's a trust officer, and moved into those areas and did that. And of course, we introduced many other things, but those I particularly recall.
It would have been following also the social trends that occurred in this time, too.
Yes.
Where a woman was given more a place in the community of her own rather than simply because she was the wife of so-and-so.
Yes.
Yes. And your articles that you had changed, I would imagine that at the time before you took over, it was reported exactly who was there, With lists of names, I suppose.
Committees after committees after committees, who presided. And there was so much, shall we say, rhubarb that could have been cut out, not because we didn't feel that it was important, and I'm sure it would be to the organizations, but it tied us up space-wise and time-wise, and we couldn't get to anything else. And I recall, I won't mention the organization, but it's a well-known one, an alliance in which 5 pages of double-spaced typing would be sent in on one meeting in the evening alone.
My word.
And it's that sort of thing that we had to break down, because we felt that while each meeting was of importance to the members, the respective members, and possibly a few of their friends and a few of their neighbors, it was time to bring in news that was of interest to everyone, to let the community know what was going on. So you had to break with old traditions, and it isn't always easy.
No, I'm sure you had many comments that were made, and perhaps...
Some good, some bad.
Yes, I'm sure. Now, as far as the amount of space that was given to the society page, what was called the society page, now it would be referred to as the woman's page, wouldn't it?
That's right.
Have you always had roughly the same amount of space to deal
with? No. So much of the time, that depended on the amount of advertising for that particular day. Now, they tried to have to stay as closely as possible to a percentage. In other words, they might decide that year they were going to go 60% advertising and 40% news. And sometimes I would have 2 full pages to work with. But then again, if there are quite a few ads in there, I would have to trim and cut down to a page and a half. But someone from the advertising department would always check in the morning and ask, how much space do you need? You go quickly over your list and see how much news you were having for that day and say, I could use a page and a half. And she would try as closely as possible to give us that. And if she couldn't, well, then we'd have to hold some of it till the next day.
I think this is what the layman often doesn't understand, that you don't print all the news necessarily that you have. You don't always have space in order to do that, but there is the factor that controls it very heavily is the amount of advertising.
That's right. And unfortunately, it has to, because that's paid for and must go on the designated day, where our news is a voluntary contribution with no finances involved. And so we have to go along with whatever space we are given. I say we as if I were still there, but
well, it's very much a part of your life.
Yes.
And you are knowledgeable of the subject, obviously. Any particular features that you remember in that time? For instance, I recall hearing about something called Ear to the Ground.
Oh, we started that as sort of an entertainment feature, and that would be amusing anecdotes that would be contributed, or that we would here. I could be at a meeting and unaware that I was there, I would hear different people reciting different things. But I followed this rule. If it involved names, I never used them without permission. If it didn't involve names, well, then I felt free to use them. That ran on for about 2 years. And then the pressure of other assignments came on, and I didn't have the time to, because that requires a lot of digging. And we had to let that go in favor of the routine news that came. But it was interesting, and frequently to this day I'll have someone say, I still have the little story in the Ear to the Ground about my son or my daughter, and I have it filed in his book.
Oh my. So it is definitely remembered.
You know, and the most amusing ones were children's.
Oh, I'm
you know,
sure.
Sayings, yes.
I'm sure. And what about something called Camera Capers?
Well, that started out with the late Ray Miller, who was our official photographer, and myself, and we decided to try for a series of what was mostly a guessing game. And he would take pictures of various things around the city. We would give just enough of a clue to help you decide where it was, but the main object was to see how observing you were. And incidentally, it brought out a great deal of history of Alliance, because as we went around, we found that there were historical facts We found our first, the very first schoolhouse down in the north end of town. We found the site of the old noodle factory on West Vine Street. Used to make noodles and saved the whites to sell by the quart to the housewives in the area.
Yes, I've heard of that. Llewellyn, I think,
yes,
was the name.
Yes, that's right.
There. Yes.
And then we found an old stepping stone that was on the corner of, I believe, Columbia and Freedom, and discovered that that was used in the very early days as a stepping stones for the ladies to get into their carriage.
When we would have had the horse and carriage.
That's right. It has since been moved down to the Hartzell Museum, and it's on the lawn of the Hartzell Museum. And we discovered the only Revolutionary soldier that we had buried in the Old River Cemetery, found his tombstone. We found, and I believe, if my memory serves me right, lions that were, they were ornamental, that were at the entrance of a home in the north end of town that had once been lived in by the Walter Wright family and his parents. Because at one time, the north end of town was the end of town,
the
and of course it started
section.
Yes, it was, and then of course it started moving south.
At one time too, Union Avenue was quite a
beautiful,
section of palatial homes.
Beautiful palatial homes,
which
yes.
Many of them are gone now.
Yes.
And some
are
still remain, but
fraternity
are businesses
houses and,
too.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the Turkle Funeral Home.
Yes.
That home.
And then the Myers Funeral Home too as well.
Myers and some of the others along there. The Reeves home was torn down for the YMCA.
Yes.
Was there?
And of course the Woman's Club is the old Walter Webb home.
True.
I shouldn't say old Walter Webb.
Well,
he's still with us.
The home itself,
yes,
is much older. Yes. But yes, this is what's so difficult to realize, that areas of town now that are not considered prime residential areas,
yes,
were at one time. And some of that fine architecture, if you drive through there,
I know,
is still present. Yes. How did you get your ideas for finding these places? I'm amazed at the digging you did.
I think we actually started with the most familiar one of all, and that is the Lincoln Memorial down near the Pennsylvania Rail Station.
Right.
And we started with that, and then it would be hearsay, and I remember the old Lexington Hotel, there was a bronze plate with some numbers at the side of the building, near the sidewalk. We found out that was, of all things, a sea level mark. So we took the picture of that. There is a home that has, and I think it's still standing, it may not be, maybe it's given way to the new Salvation Army building, but it had a widow's peak cone at the top of the roof, quite sharply defined. And we just go from one thing to another. Now, not all of our pictures yielded history. It was more observation. But we found out that we used this once a week. And we found out that when people would read it and start guessing, then we printed the answer the following week with a new picture.
I see. They had to wait a whole week.
Yes.
I see.
So we enjoyed it. We went from Alliance to Sebring, and when we exhausted everything we could possibly think of there, we went into Minerva and worked there. But after 2 years, we finally exhausted everything. You couldn't get too far from home because people would not be seeing the things that we photographed. And so it came to an end.
Well, it seems as though enough time has passed since then, and certainly it would pique the curiosity about local history and your powers of observation. It sounds like a good one to run again, doesn't it?
Well, and it was a lot of fun to do it, and Ray enjoyed it so much, of course, from the photographer's angle.
Oh, yes. And, of course, there's where his powers of observation mm-hmm. would have come through. Plus, I would think that many of these things were not too easy to photograph.
No, they weren't. And sometimes he had to use a wide-angle lens because he had to get in an area, and they were not easy. And sometimes he would have to go back when the light was just right. There have been improvements in photography over the days when he took it, but he enjoyed it. It was a challenge to him,
oh,
and that's why he enjoyed it.
And I think a challenge to the readers, too. Now, you mentioned this would have appeared once a week. In the 30 years that you were at the Review, was it a daily paper
yes.
all those years?
Yes.
Okay, because way, 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 way back then, it was at one time.
Well, that would be way back in the beginning.
About the turn of the century,
yes,
I'm thinking.
Yes, because it had been a daily for a long, long time.
Okay, so they would have waited. It would have been published once a week, and then they would have had to go and buy all those...
To the next Saturday.
To the next Saturday to wait for the answer. Did you ever have anyone call and try to get the answer out of you?
I remember having people call to say, I think I know the answer, but we didn't give it to them, not until it was printed. And then I understand that on Main Street, there would be a number of people as soon as the paper came out, and they would look at it, and then they'd make bets on who had the right answer.
Bets can be made on most anything, that's true. When you mentioned then the change in the society page, and an opportunity by cleaning up some articles or let's just say highlighting the events rather than spelling out in detail.
In their line of importance.
Yes.
Because a news item is generally written according to formula whereby if an editor wants to cut, he should be able to cut from the bottom up without taking out the meat of the story. If you put everything that's absolutely necessary in the beginning, and then the rest that you add is extraneous, so that if you're pressed for space, and even the man out in the composing room has to cut, he can cut the bottom or next to the bottom paragraph, and he hasn't destroyed the meaning of the story.
Very interesting.
So you have to write it that way.
Yes. Well, when you found then that you had more space for your feature stories, were you then, as society editor, able to go out and do these feature stories?
Yes.
I think you would have enjoyed that, too.
And, of course, I always had someone working with me. Now, my predecessor, Althea, worked alone. And, of course, it was a killer because she put out the entire page by herself. But she had a late deadline, which was 12 noon. And when I went in, they lowered it to 11. Several years later, they lowered it to 10. And when I retired, it was 9:30 in the morning. So from 7 to 9:30, everything had to be taken over the phone or rewritten.